Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Movie Geeks United Oscar nominee spotlight. Tonight, we have a conversation with Mr. Robert Stromberg, who is up for Best Achievement in Art Direction this year for his stunning work on the groundbreaking film Avatar. To begin the conversation, Robert tells us all about the nerves he's feeling in anticipation of the big event.
When I heard, I was with my wife the morning they announced, and of course we were, both of us had our laptops open, and we were like two little kids, sort of waiting, and it kept going on and on. They wouldn't list the names, and one of the announcers on TV mentioned that Avatar got 9 nominations, and we both looked at each other wide-eyed, and then really frantically started to search. But we finally got it, and we high-fived and chest bumped, it was a thrilling morning.
Yeah, I bet it was. But you've actually been nominated previously for work you did on Master and Commander, right?
Yeah, it was a different category. I was in the visual effects category, and I guess I'm trying to, before I die, cover all the categories.
But, right.
It'll lead into, visual effect for me is what led me into production design. It was something that evolved into production design through mm-hmm. visual effects. Well, first of all, matte painting, that's what I did forever. And, on a certain level, matte painting is design, and it's usually something that's done after the production designer has already left the show, and there's a movie filled with green screens and things that need to go into it, and so as a matte artist, you're sort of designing one shot at a time, and I always felt it important that I knew where that one shot fit into the complete structure of the film. Mm-hmm. In other words, I never wanted one of my shots to sort of stand out. So I always tried to understand what type of film I was working on and what that shot was, the context of the mood of that particular moment in the movie, and so on.
Yeah.
So that being said, it was sort of this, this training ground for years of understanding design.
So, transitioning between matte work and visual effects and production design, that's kind of like a linear transition. A lot of people follow that path, you find? Or?
No, I think it's actually a little bit unusual, actually. Most people go the predicted route through, either illustration into, and find themselves in an art department.
Right.
And learn the workings of what a production designer does, and then becoming an art director, and then eventually graduating to production design. Whereas, I pretty much stumbled over a rock and fell into it. After meeting Cameron, he sort of opened that door for me.
Well, I want to talk to you all about Avatar and some of these other great credits you have on your resume, but tell me what inspired you to enter the world of film to begin with. I know that your father was a filmmaker, wasn't he?
Yeah, I grew up with, as a very small child, I grew up with my dad making monster movies in our garage, basically, stop motion. He was a huge fan of Willis O'Brien and Ray Harryhausen and so on, and you know, they were his idols, and he used to make films, based around that technology at the time. But my dad was also great friends with a teenage Phil Tippett, who obviously went on to win multiple Oscars and be a leading creature guy in Hollywood, you know, Jurassic Park and so on. So I learned a great deal, even as a six-year-old, watching my dad and Phil Tippett doing stop motion, and I became fascinated with the environments that they were working in, and started to actually help my dad build some of these miniature environments.
Right.
Excuse me. So you worked with your dad on the Crater Lake Monster?
The Crater Lake Monster was you know, when I was entering, becoming a teenager, and I was more into sports and stuff at that time. But I was actually in Crater Lake Monster as a child, and my dad went off and filmed that for 3 months. I didn't see him, and then he came back, and then he was spending most of his time in Los Angeles, where we grew up in the San Diego area, and the Crater Lake Monster was this, $250,000 low budget thing.
That
he had the talents of Phil Tippett and another visual effects guy, Randy Cook, who's also an Oscar winner. Both of those guys did the monster in his little low budget film.
Right. Now that's a staple of late night television growing up for us up. So that's cool. That's wonderful.
So you obviously gained a lot of love for this art form from your father and his collaborators. So how did you go about breaking into the business yourself?
Well, I became interested in matte painting probably by the time I was 9 years old, and my dad was nothing but supportive. I think some dads, play catch with their son. My dad and I, we'd take a piece of glass out, and I'd do a matte painting, and he would photograph it for me, and I learned not only the sort of art of matte painting, but also my dad taught me the in and outs of camera work, which is essential in understanding, the basics of film work.
Yeah. So what were your ultimate goals? Your ultimate goal was to be a working matte painter, or did you foresee a future where you'd get into production design? And
Not once before, believe it or not, not once before 2005 did I even think about production design. I actually wanted to pursue directing. And what I wanted to be was, I was fascinated by matte paintings and how the idea of doing something that simple could fool people, and it became almost an obsession to try and trick people to where they didn't know there was anything going on. And as soon as, when people ask you, there were no visual effects in that, and there were, that's sort of the ultimate compliment. And the matte painting led to the visual effects supervision, and I did a number of films, Walk the Line and Memoirs of a Geisha and some other films that are really not known for visual effects. They're just I became fascinated with the seamless visual effects because I felt that was sort of a better magician's trick. And where other people pursued the best looking animated dragons and so on, I pursued the photo reel part of visual effects, and that supervision, and I was always flattered when the directors of photography for those films, Dion Beebe for Geisha, and and Master and Commander, of course, Russell Boyd, and so on and so on. These are all cinematographers who won Oscars for those films, and I always felt that in some small little way I helped them to achieve that. It was just sort of an overall team victory in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But
absolutely.
With director photography can do wonderful things, but there's a scope that a good digital mad artist can bring to a film as well, and so that was where I thought I was going to stay for a long time, and I still actually do map paintings. I still love it.
You did it as recently as 2012, didn't you? The film.
I'm doing one right now.
Oh.
I'm working. In between Avatar and Alice in Wonderland, I supervised the miniseries John Adams for HBO.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And we ended up doing about 30 or 40 map paintings for that.
Wow.
And so the visual effects supervision led to meeting Peter Weir. And what I found out with Peter is that, he's a great, obviously a great director and a truly wonderful human being. And but he didn't understand he really wasn't savvy in the sort of latest digital technology. And so I became this guy who traveled with him for a year on Master and Commander, just essentially translating to Industrial Light and Magic and other facilities what Peter wanted. And that sort of coined a new job description, which then I became a visual effects designer.
Right.
And which is an important role for sort of theming together the director, production designer, and visual effects team. And when I walked into the Avatar, I met Jim for the first time, I went in with the notion that I was the visual effects designer.
Mm-hmm. And he sprang it on you that he wanted you to assume the role of production designer.
Yeah, that it developed over time. Actually, I mean, I've told the story, but I had never met Jim before, and a producer friend of mine called and asked if I had a couple weeks to help out Jim. He was doing a studio presentation and needed some artwork and some help getting a presentation together. This was before Avatar was greenlit. And, I asked this friend of mine, well, can you tell me what the film is? And she said, well, I can't, but it takes place on a jungle alien planet and there's floating mountains or something in it. And I said, okay. And I was going to meet Jim the next morning, so I decided to stay up all night, and I did two digital images of my interpretation of Pandora, and not knowing it was called Pandora. But I did that, and I went in and met with Jim, and I put him up on the monitor, and he basically just stood up and he pointed at the screen and he said, "That's my movie." And those images that I did that one night are actually pretty much what's still the look of what's in the movie.
Mm-hmm. And those images were what exactly?
One was a huge vista, a jungle landscape with the multiple suns and large planet. I put a large planet in just by dumb luck that was actually in the script.
Mm-hmm.
And the floating mountains and what that might look like. And the other image was a jungle landscape with alien plants. And so that led to a creative connection right away with Jim. And 2 weeks turned into four, and then 3 months, and then a year. And by the end of the first year and a half, we had designed so much that he pulled me aside and he said, pretty much that, well, you're designing this whole thing, so this is your new job title.
Well, from what I've heard from everyone involved, you guys were actively putting it together, and yet there was an aspect to the process where you didn't know if much of it was going to be possible.
First of all, I have to say that, I am a co-production designer with Rick Carter, and I'll talk to you about that in a minute, because it's a very important aspect to the co-production design thing. But when we first ventured into this, the technology was kind of there, and but we had to force it to work, and over time, through trial and error, of course, and we figured it out. The whole, I used to always say it felt like we were, creating an airplane in flight, and in a sense it was, because from the first stuff that we did to where we ended up was just miles apart in complexity and so on. By the time we were done, we were fully lighting these digital sets that Jim was working in. It was actually, a fascinating process. We had two traditional art departments, one in Los Angeles and one in New Zealand. We also had a virtual art department in Los Angeles. And so in the traditional art department is where we did all of the concept and design work. In the virtual art department, we built these virtual sets, which allowed Jim to direct in a virtual environment for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Right. The technology is so amazing, and obviously Avatar is a big milestone in cinema history for a number of reasons. But the technology seems to have caught up to a point where anything the filmmakers can imagine, they can bring to fruition. When you're putting this together, were there any ideas or concepts that you had that technically you could not achieve?
The short answer is no. I think once we felt that we had it, it opened up all possibilities, and we weren't limited by scope. We weren't limited by depth. We weren't limited by, camera. We anything and everything, design-wise, became achievable, and that was part of the excitement of it. Is that we could see, at a certain point, we could see where this was going to be, and in the future, how other creative people would use this. It opens up a whole new palette for the next generation of creative people.
It really does, yeah.
Yeah.
And the world of Pandora, when you read the script and in your conversations with Mr. Cameron, he obviously had a very vivid idea of what he wanted this world to look like. Tell me what you... you guys saw the same environment from the beginning, or did you have input that he hadn't thought of, elements of the planet that he hadn't have considered?
Oh yeah, obviously we started digging in design-wise to what was in, at the time it wasn't even a script, it was a treatment. And
right.
So we started digging into that, and we became very comfortable with that creative. It was actually a very small group of people in the very beginning, and it was more like a bunch of guys getting together. It was probably five or six of us, and so it wasn't distracting. We all knew each other. We all knew what we could do, and it was a very collaborative forum. And with my matte painting background, it, to my advantage, it created the ability to talk in that kind of scope and talk about depth and talk about atmospheric perspective and composition,
right,
and so on. And so the language was built in, and I think that's why we connected. I immediately, rather than bring in traditional illustrators, I brought in matte artists.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that had a great deal to do with solving some of these issues that seemed impossible, because by bringing in matte artists, and not nothing against illustrators, because we're all illustrators as well, but matte artists understand the photoreal aspect of what it's going to be, and I felt that was important to sort of nail it up front.
Right. But looking over your resume, you've worked with on projects directed by some of our greatest filmmakers, and I'm curious to know, how is James Cameron unique amongst those filmmakers for you?
Yeah, I was just talking to somebody about this. It's interesting, working with so many different directors. They all do the same job. They direct the movie, but the wide style differences, it always fascinates me. With Jim, he's not only an artist himself, but he understands technology and he understands physics and everything else. And I truly felt every day I was working with a genius, and I was.
Mm-hmm.
You have to, obviously respect, his, what he is going for, but at the same time, he is also looking for people to jump in and be part. He's as much as an independent guy is, he's very much a team player. And once you're on that team, it's like being in battle with somebody, and they support each other and do anything that they can to win the war.
In the industry, the visual effects, art direction, production design industry, is he the top kind of visionary director? Like, back in the Star Wars times, I'm sure George Lucas was that figure for many people.
Yeah.
Is Cameron reached that status now for that industry?
Yeah, he is. I mean, he's so well rounded in everything, and I think he's a pioneer.
Mm-hmm.
In so many ways, he's a rare combination where he not only makes films that people like to see, but he also is setting a path for what's going to happen 5 years from now, and so he's always in tune with the latest or what could be, and where other directors are a little bit focused on the moment and the immediate problem. I've been lucky enough to work with some of the best, Tim Burton is another great one, but he's more of a true design artist himself. Tim Burton could be a production designer tomorrow and everybody would understand why. Working with Cameron, like I said, it's a team effort too. Until the last bullet is shot. And with Tim, it's a little bit different. Where I had a great time working with him in designing, but you get it to about 85%, and then he then comes in and really makes it. And of course we collaborate along the way, but then he really digs in and puts those Tim Burton fingerprints on it.
Yeah. Two of the most visionary directors currently working, and you work with them back to back in Cameron and Burton. I mean, that must be a dream for you.
Yeah, an unexpected dream. I mean, growing up, I was always a huge fan of both of them, but Tim Burton especially, coming from a design background myself,
mm-hmm.
and I was a huge fan, and I always felt a true respect for Tim growing up, because he was one of the only guys sort of taking a risk and really making something wild, and
yeah.
you know, he just wasn't a pedestrian kind of thinker. And you know, going back to Beetlejuice and some of these things, I mean, they don't always look completely real, but you didn't care because it was just wacky and fun. And,
yeah.
You know, so when I approached Alice, you know, I first of all sat down and watched all of his movies. And, you know, I decided to throw you know, elements, the color and so on, of, you know, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Beetlejuice, and combine that with The Darkness of Sleepy Hollow and see what that would, you know, what that would look like. And so we went down that road, and that look sort of stuck. And Tim, you know, Tim had, you know, great creative ideas along the way. But you know, at the end of the day, it in order to be you know, a true Tim Burton movie, he loves and has to be involved on all aspects of the creativity.
Yeah.
So I mean, it blows my mind that these guys can do this and pay attention to what the actors are doing. So,
right.
Yeah, my hat's off to both of them.
We actually, before I let you go, go ahead, Jerry.
I don't mean to backtrack. I just wanted to backtrack to a couple of years ago. You worked on a lot of visually fascinating movies, but there's one in particular I'm curious about. That's Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow. And
yeah.
I was just curious, what was your role in the film, and how did you bring that ticket into life? Because it's a fascinating film. I know it's not not popular with a lot of people, but reading interviews with Cary Coran at the time and reading the actors and everything, the way that film was conceived, I have always found fascinating, and I hope he makes another movie.
Yeah, no, Cary and I actually got along famously. We met, and you know, I saw the 7-minute you know, a bit that he had made, and
mm-hmm.
and I too was an immediate fan, because you know, I loved the look and the and immediately wanted to get involved. So I started doing some, you know, black and white illustrations,
mm-hmm.
and I was always a fan of the old black and white cinematographers and
right.
the use of light and dark and light, and you know, so I've always wanted to somehow weave that into whatever I do, and that opportunity came along, and so those shots, you know, the style and the shots fascinated me, and
mm-hmm.
I did, you know, I worked with him on a bunch of stuff, but the main sequence I did was the sequence through the Himalayas.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much the whole sequence. There was probably about 40 matte paintings in there. That's what I mean by taking a chance. He was taking a risk in a visual style that could either, come back to haunt you or do something that's truly original. I thought that it was. And to be honest with you, I wish somebody else would do another film in that style, because it is beautiful.
We have an actual a listener question for you.
Sure.
It's an aspiring matte artist, and his name is Matthew Schuerman, and his question to you is, the industry has changed so much in the last 2 years that one matte painter I know of can't get jobs if he calls himself a matte painter. He now has to call himself an environment artist. So do you have any advice for aspiring matte painters in this dramatically changing industry?
Well, I think that when I hire somebody, it's based on not just on, obviously the artistic skills are important, but it's also about the philosophy of what they're doing. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I know a lot of texture artists who call themselves matte artists. And, to be hired and be recognized by a lot of these top people, you have to do something that evokes emotion, and do something that's not just copying somebody else's images. It's, it's you know, I think that, and also I think that today's mad artists should absolutely know the you know, some 3D. A lot of the environments these days, even the 2D mat artists, I find myself doing 2.5D mat paintings a lot, which is and projection mat paintings and so on. So it's evolving. I think that the more technology you know, even as an artist, the better off you'll be. And I think that the industry is really looking for people who are not only creative but technically savvy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's upcoming for you? What are you working on now?
Well, right now I'm involved with three HBO projects, you know, in talks about designing a couple of the films. I don't think I'm supposed to mention. So,
okay.
It's an exciting time between Avatar and Alice in Wonderland that ate up, 7 years of my life, and I do have two kids, and so, you know, I'm happily right at the moment, getting to know my kids.
Well, you know, after that commitment with Avatar and Alice, I mean, you absolutely deserve it. That,
yeah, definitely.
Stunning work, and I'll be so excited for you on Oscar night. We'll both be sitting there rooting for you.
Well, if I don't win it, don't be sad. I've had a really great ride with both of these films. Avatar is something that if I didn't work on, I would be just like everybody else, sitting there with my mouth wide open.
Yeah. It really is this generation Star Wars in a way that I think it can inspire people. Just on one level, inspire people to get into this realm of filmmaking, by the experience of watching it.
I think especially today, I mean, when I was growing up, it was much harder to get the equipment to do this, to get anybody interested. And, you know, the technology and the equipment is so easily accessible and at your fingertips now that there really are no excuses for people getting out there and doing things. And I think the future is very bright for young, talented people.
Okay, that is Mr. Robert Stromberg. He is up for Best Achievement in Art Direction for his stellar work in the film Avatar. Check out our other episodes in our Oscar nominee interview spotlight series, including conversations with Best Actor nominee Jeremy Renner from The Hurt Locker, Best Documentary Feature Director nominee Robert Kenner for Food, Inc., Best Adapted Screenplay nominee Armando Iannucci for In the Loop, Best Makeup nominee Barney Berman for Star Trek, Julian Clark, who's up for Best Editing for District 9, Best Documentary Short Subject nominee Daniel Junge for The Last Campaign of Governor Booth Gardner, composers Marco Beltrami and Buck Sanders, who are up for Best Original Score for their work on The Hurt Locker, Greg Helvey, the writer-director of the Best Live-Action Short Film nominee, Kavi. And finally, Rick Goldsmith and Judith Ehrlich, who are the writers-directors of the Best Documentary nominee, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg, and the Pentagon Papers. We have got the Oscars covered for you. So between now and the big event on Sunday night, enjoy those interviews. And also check out our Predicting the Oscars special that we did in the past month. Thank you so much for joining us. Enjoy the Oscars. See you next week.